Hello, I'm Merrick Schneider. Welcome to this podcast of articles from the Wall Street Journal, a presentation of AIRS LA. You are listening to this recording, which is provided for the use of those who are blind or print impaired. Materials or items read on AIRS LA are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Today's first article is titled, "Is Drinking Alone Okay or Necessarily Lonely?" by Letty Teague. Then we have Emma Rosenblum. "As a parent, I was freaking out about AI. I got help." And then Douglas Belkin wrote, "Lawyers more often are getting extra time for the bar." We'll follow that up with Roseanne Fernandez's article, "A Harvard Tap on AIDS Has Students Smarting," and then we'll have one more by Alan Ripp, "A Good Husband Walks." All these articles are from recent edition of the Wall Street Journal. So let's begin with today's first one. Is drinking alone okay or necessarily lonely? Wine is a social beverage, one that's best shared. But can drinking alone actually be bad for your mental health? I was thinking about solo drinking after reading a 2025 Gallup poll wherein 19.9% of the United States adults surveyed reported feelings of loneliness. The same polling found that loneliness is on the rise, while other studies have found connection between loneliness and excessive alcohol consumption. Of course, enjoying a solo glass of wine does not mean that you're lonely or that you have an alcohol problem. So why is the topic of solo drinking so often fraught? What's your comfort level? While I typically drink in the company of others, I will enjoy an occasional glass by myself, and I know quite a few wine lovers who do the same. Other people I know say that drinking alone can make them feel self-conscious. My friend Maya has no problem drinking a glass alone at home if her husband is away, she said, but would never go solo into a bar. I feel like if I sit alone at a bar, it gives off a vibe that I want to be picked up. Holly, a lawyer who commutes between her New York office and her suburban home, said, "I definitely do not feel self-conscious about drinking alone. If I miss my train, I might go to a bar for a drink." For Holly's wife, Lori, it depends on where the drinking happens. "I don't drink alone at home, and I don't see the need for it," Lori said. "Drinking is a social act." She has no issue, however, with anyone having a solo drink in a social space like a bar or restaurant. What's her solo strategy? "If my friend Allison, who lives alone, makes herself a nice meal, a glass of wine seems an appropriate accompaniment. It's not like I'm eating cereal for dinner," she said. "When my husband has dinner plans or is away on a trip, I too will make myself a nice dinner accompanied by wine. For me, the question is how much the wine should cost. My price ceiling for a solo bottle is around $25, and I prefer a bottle closed with a screw cap. I know I will not consume the whole bottle, and I find that leftover wine in a screw cap bottle tends to taste fresher a bit longer. A few wine pros I talk with have their own price ceilings for solo bottles. Rick Badowski, general manager of the Gary's Wine and Marketplace store in Madison, New Jersey, also caps it at $25, while the store's assistant manager, Jen Neinstein, said she would spend up to $30. Neither Badowski or Nielsen feels any compulsion about drinking solo, but both find many customers are shy about broaching the topic. They'll preface it with, "I don't know if I should just get a whole bottle since it's just me. Then we'll talk about wine preservation systems," Neinstein said. Some customers will opt for a half bottle. How about in a restaurant? Wine director Lee Campbell of Borgo in New York sees quite a few solo diners. Most order wine, usually by the glass. Some will order a bottle and share it with staff. Barbara Wang, head sommelier at Le Bon Nordin in New York, agreed that solo diners and drinkers are common. "I think the stigma is fading," she said. She added that she and her staff go out of their way to make solo diners feel welcome. Wang herself appears unhampered by self-consciousness around dining and drinking alone. She recalled a recent solo meal at a restaurant where she ordered a full bottle of wine to accompany her branzino and shared it with the sommelier who assisted with its selection. "I decided to test Wang's fading stigma hypothesis out in the world by doing something I do not do habitually, sitting alone at a bar. At least that was my plan. I arrived early to a restaurant where my husband and I planned to dine with our friend Bert. As I sat down at the bar and ordered a glass of Chambly, I saw no other unaccompanied women. There were, however, several sole male drinkers, including Bert, sipping a good-sized martini. When I mentioned that my husband was afraid I might get picked up, Bert reported that he had recently been picked up by a group of people beside him at the bar. Drinking alone, he assured me, can be a most sociable act." And now, as a parent, I was freaking out about AI. I got help. Artificial intelligence has come for parenting. No, I don't mean that your children will soon be disciplined by chatbots or diaper changed by robots. I mean that AI now sits squarely atop the pile of modern parents' anxiety, having rapidly eclipsed bogeymen like screen time and social media. Your kid is begging for a phone? That seems quaint in comparison to the full-blown panic that he or she will graduate into a dystopian future in which there are no jobs, autonomous systems have assumed control of the military, and the economy is divided into a billionaire class and their legions of serfs. If that seems extreme, welcome to my mom brain at 4 a.m. I've been sleeping less lately because of AI anxiety, thinking there's no turning back and this could quickly get out of control, a dad friend of mine echoed after I solicited thoughts on the matter on Instagram. The responses came in hot. "It scares the blank out of me," one mom wrote. "Our schools are grossly unprepared for this," said another. "I've been thinking a lot about how the careers that my kids would excel at probably won't exist and questioning what they will do instead," said another. "My husband, who works in tech, thinks our kids won't go to college because in-person learning will change. Also, that we will have to save all our money because they won't have jobs. He's freaking out," wrote a friend. The topic now comes up at every dinner party and parent gathering, where conversations circle various catastrophic outcomes. In 10 years, everyone will be on universal basic income until somebody mercifully offers but another bottle of wine. Yes, please. I was sent a flyer for a panel at a New York City private school called Parenting in the Age of AI, featuring speakers who promised tips on how to prepare your children and yourselves in the evolving world of artificial intelligence. But how can you protect them from something that's changing so rapidly? The uncertainty and fear surrounding AI is being grappled with society-wide, but it hits parents particularly hard. A recent Brookings report issued dire warnings about the effects of AI on learning, saying it would lead to the great unwiring of students' cognitive capability. The American Psychological Association released research on adolescents, indicating that strong attachments to AI-generated characters may contribute to struggles with learning social skills and developing emotional connections. My oldest son, who's 10, knows that ChatGPT is not really a person, but it sure as heck sounds like one, even to me. We were told that if we put our children in the right schools, if we allow them to feel their feelings, if we make sure they get enough sleep, stay off chat Snapchat and never touch a Dorito, they will attend a good college and have a respectable career. The looming threat of AI has upended that formula, and it does not feel fair. Will our kids learn how to think for themselves? Will they be able to relate to other humans? Or will I end up being the mother-in-law to a chatbot? It makes sense that parents are stressed about AI, especially if they're seeing it everywhere on every podcast and in every headline, said Meredith Elkins, a clinical psychologist and the author of Parenting Anxiety, Breaking the Cycle of Worry, and Raising Resilient Kids. We've been so outcome-focused, so focused on the college and the job and the economic security, says Elkins, who does have a PhD. Because so much of that is out of our control right now, that gives us the chance to focus more on the process. I ask if she has any actionable tips, and she suggests a helpful reframe, one that does not include deep research into AI-proof careers. I've heard of parents doing this, or pricing out upstate farmland in case we have to live off the grid. I've done this myself at 4 a.m. Ultimately, the task of parenting has not changed despite the demoralization of AI. It's still about how can we raise adaptable, grounded humans who can respond to disruptions, and even more important, who believe they can respond to disruptions, says Elkins. In other words, the only way to AI-proof your kid is to teach them, in the wise words of Chumbawamba, that they'll get knocked down, but they will get up again. Resiliency is the key to functioning in a world moving so quickly under their feet. Elkins assures me this will be easier than I think. You see your kid is doing a great job tolerating frustration, say, the video game console breaks, and instead of throwing it against the wall, they fix it. That's an opportunity to be like, hey, you dealt with that really well, she says. Or when you notice flexibility, they were supposed to go to a friend's house and someone got sick, but they pivoted nicely, you can say, I saw you rebounded really well. She suggests encouraging her kids to take initiative rather than waiting for instructions, take healthy risks, and do things more independently. These are core skills that research tells us over and over are related to long-term adaptability, Elkins adds. And finally, Elkins gently reminds me this also applies to grown-ups. If we're modeling our anxiety about this, we're radiating urgency, alarm, and pressure. Our kids learn to feel that way too. In other words, try as best you can to stop the AI panic swirl. It's not helpful, and your children will absorb your hysteria. After my conversation with Elkins, I approached one of my sons. He'd recently been nervous about starting a new activity, but he persevered, and so I said to him, I'm proud of how well you dealt with that challenge. He looked at me like I was a lunatic, but he heard me, so perhaps I planted a seed. That night, I went to bed without Googling AI Tumani or how to get a plumber's license. And for the first time in a while, I slept till morning. And now, lawyers more often are getting extra time for the bar. More aspiring lawyers are asking for and getting extra time to finish the bar exam, a Wall Street Journal analysis has found. In California, where more people take the bar than in any other state, 14% of the nearly 8,000 test takers in a recent exam received accommodation, up from 4% a decade earlier, the state bar said. The development follows one coursing through high schools and colleges. More students have diagnoses for disabilities like ADHD and receive extra time for homework or the SAT. The phenomenon has reached professional licensing exam, and law firms are adapting by launching programs to support associates. Perry Zirkel, a disability law scholar and former dean at Pennsylvania's Lehigh University, said the need for testing accommodations for disabled students is real, but he worries about unfairness. Families that can pay for disability assessments, he said, gaining advantages by gaming the system. This gives the benefit to those who already have power and privilege, and once they get good at it, they just simply keep playing the game, Zirkle said. The increase traces primarily to two sources, rising rates of diagnosis, an amendment in 2008 to the American with Disabilities Act that widened eligibility, he said. The changes stem partly from a desire to help veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan with conditions such as PTSD. At some affluent high schools, more than 30% of students have disability diagnoses and receive accommodations. Some colleges reflect this surge. At Hampshire College and Smith College, both in Massachusetts, as well as at Pace University in New York, more than one in three students claim a disability, federal data show. By contrast, less than 3% of students at Springfield Technical Community College, 20 miles from Smith, claim disabilities. The pattern carries into postgraduate education. At some law schools, more than 20% of students had testing accommodations in recent years. A study in the Oregon Law Review that examined enrollment at 60 schools between 2021 and 2023 showed. The increase in California paralleled those elsewhere. In Washington, D.C., 15% of test takers received accommodations, up from 5% a decade earlier, according to the district's Courts of Appeal, which administers the exam. Nearly 12% received accommodations back in July, which is the most popular city. In Illinois, 13% of bar takers received accommodations on recent exam, up from 2% a decade earlier. In Georgia, the share rose to 7% from 2% over roughly the same period. In California, the most common category for accommodation is psychological conditions, which can include ADHD, anxiety, and learning disabilities. In recent years, about 60% of the accommodations the state granted fell into that category, while 32% were for physical disabilities. Back in February 2025, 65% of those with accommodations passed the California bar, compared with 58% of all test takers. About 90% of applicants who sought an accommodation received one, and 97% were for extended time. The State Bar says its methodology for tracking accommodations has varied somewhat over the years. Law firms are navigating growing numbers of new attorneys arriving with psychological disability diagnoses. Caitlin Vaughn, a managing director at Goodwin Proctor, a global firm with 1,800 attorneys, believes the number of people with conditions like ADHD has not changed, but is being recognized more often. I would be a little leery of supporting that it's a gaming of the system in order to get some unfair advantage, Vaughn said. Taking initiative, being a self-starter, and being able to advocate for yourself is a skill set that is helpful when you practice law. Back in 2024, Goodwin Proctor started a program called Thriving with ADHD, which addressed issues around task initiation, sleep, mental health, and working with colleagues with ADHD. The firm's goal is to improve productivity and enhance lawyers' professional performance, Vaughn said. One practice that emerged from is body doubling, which pairs attorneys who struggle with starting tasks with accountability partners. They meet online, discuss what they need to accomplish, work in silence, and reconvene to review what they got done. Outside law, professional organizations, including those representing financial professionals and engineers, declined to provide data on accommodations for professional exams. ETFs, which administers testing for teachers, also declined. Test takers with accommodations on two major nursing exams rose to 2.6 last year from 1.3% in 2016, the first year for which data was available. On exams for dental professionals, the rate climbed to 1.7% from 0.5% back in 2015. Now, a Harvard cap on A's has students smarting. For years, Harvard has been handing out A's in abundance. Now, a proposed cap would pump the brakes, and students are up in arms. Harvard's faculty is set to vote soon on a proposal to cap the number of A's per course, which now make up more than half of undergraduate grades after years of inflation. The plan also suggests getting rid of GPA as an internal metric, instead using percentile rank to calculate honors like cum laude recognition. A frenzied debate has gripped campus, with students protesting that the changes would increase stress, fuel competition, and discourage academic exploration. An editorial in the student newspaper proclaimed the cap a crude quota. Student-made memes depict the administration behind the proposal as Gandalf from Lord of the Rings saying, "You shall not pass," or as Dolores Umbridge, the tyrannical Hogwarts headmistress from Harry Potter. A survey conducted by Harvard's undergrad student government found that about 94% of students opposed the policy to cap A's based on over 800 responses. The fact that this policy even might go into effect with 94% student disapproval is absurd and goes to show how much the administration cares about it, said one commentator on a discussion forum. Harvard administrators and some faculty counter that the goal is to fix the culture and challenge students to invest in their coursework. The school has a duty to protect the value of student degrees by curbing grade inflation, said Amanda Claybaugh, the dean of undergraduate education. We have to do what's in the interest of preserving the reputation of Harvard, and they all benefit from that, she said. The proposal would cap the number of A's per course at 20%, plus an additional 4 A's to account for smaller courses with more variability. The cap would effectively reset A's to Harvard's 2011 level, said the proposal, which applied to the undergraduate college. Comes after a report released back in the fall found that about 60% of grades were A in the 24-25 school year, up from about 25% in 2005-2006. The current system, where A's are so common that anything less is stigmatized, discourages students from exploring unfamiliar subjects, said Joshua Green, a Harvard psychology professor and a member of the committee behind the proposal. He likens it to starting college with a new car and trying to go 4 years without a scratch. You're not going to take it off-road. You're not going to go do anything interesting with it, he said. The proposal would not limit A minuses, only A's. The grading proposal committee said this will make A minuses more common and therefore less taboo. We want to liberate students from the tyranny of the 4.0 and make them free to explore, Green said. We want to put the us back in A minus. John Eddy, a professor of molecular and cellular biology, said about 70% of the grades he gives are A's because that many students meet the threshold for what he considers mastery of the material. But the directive reminds faculty that A minuses should be considered full mastery of the subject, while A's are reserved for extraordinary distinction. Freshman Anthony Wang questions that point. The A cap seems arbitrary, and shifting to A minuses feels inconsequential, he said. We haven't fought the root cause, the chemistry major said. We're just simply changing the numbers around. Haesun Lee, a sophomore and the academic officer for Harvard Student Government, says student opposition to the cap is not just about undergrads complaining that grading may get harder. We do not want to be portrayed as students don't want to get B's. We all just want to get A's, he said. Instead, Lee says that students are more interested in addressing course engagement and rigor, particularly in courses called GEMS, which is Harvard slang for classes that offer a light workload and lenient grading. Students say they worry that a grade cap system will make an already competitive environment more toxic. There's less incentive to fight for an A in a notoriously rigorous course, said freshman Kay Huang, when students can just take an easier alternative. Just make the college experience a little more calculated, Huang said. Already, Harvard has pushed back the timeline for implementing a cap after students raised concerns, said Kleibach. If approved, the cap would go into effect in the fall of 2027, so professors have time to redesign coursework. Harvard said it learned from others who tried similar grade cap policies. Princeton implemented a cap on A's back in 2004, but repealed the policy back in 2014 after reporting it added a large element of stress to student lives. Alicia Holland, a Princeton student during that time, and now a Harvard government professor who helped craft the grade cap policy, said there was still an incentive at Princeton for collaboration and competition remains healthy. Harvard has made some progress already. In a recent email to faculty, Kleibach said A's fell to 53.4% in the fall semester from 60.2% in the prior academic year. She had previously urged faculty to address grade inflation, but the school had yet to put forth any official directives. And we do have one more today. A Good Husband Walks by Alan Rip. Social media is full of scolds criticizing men who walk ahead of their partners. It all comes down to control, power, making you feel disregarded. One trauma recovery expert explains on TikTok, diagnosing walking ahead as a symptom of narcissism. The person in front signals, I'm in charge, you follow me, while the one behind feels belittled. A popular dating influencer said such behavior demonstrates a lack of care, disrespect, or attachment avoidance. Ouch. My wife and I typically take 2 daily walks together. We're mostly side by side, but I tend to drift in front of her, especially if one of us is on the phone or we're trying to beat a crosswalk red light. In an airport, the distance between us can stretch to many yards, usually because I'm scouting the restrooms. Sarah would likely admit to some self-inflicted fall behinds. Although a wise companion in other respects, she occasionally heads that way when we're going this. When I walk with her and her friend Susan at the same time, I become their Australian shepherd, nudging them to stay on track lest they wind up at the end of a pier or down a dark alley. This past winter showed my worst walker's traits. With piles of snow at every intersection and pedestrians moving in slow motion, I regularly bolted ahead and mounted obstacles like a fullback rushing for glory, leaving Sarah somewhere behind. I believed I was forging a path for her, but she saw my varsity move as inconsiderate and selfish. Now, when we approach kids crowding the sidewalk, a curbside puddle, or a dog crouching to pee, I stop and extend my arm like Sir Walter Raleigh, offering Sarah the right of first passage. She may still go the other way, but at least she gets first dibs. We realign afterward, picking up where we left off. Sarah welcomes the gesture, and I've noticed others admiring my gallantry. I may even pick up the rear for a few blocks, which relationship savant say shows my protected side. I recently hurt my ankle, but we kept walking. On one outing, I noticed Sarah starting to draw away from me with no impediment ahead. Her pace accelerated, and I had trouble keeping up. She was not looking back. Then I remembered it was her day to pick up our granddaughter from after-school ballet. Better go on, I thought. It beats being married to a narcissist. That brings us to the end of today's articles. I'm Merrick Schneider, and I will be back soon with more articles. Thank you for listening.